are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, March 22nd, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks, pinch hitting for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, writer, political strategist, consultant to the dark side, Luke Thompson, on his observations of Cambridge Analytica. Beyond the sleaze, the lack of ethics, is there science bunk? We're getting into how campaign strategy, data mining, digital targeting, how does it actually work? The crown prince of Saudi Arabia, MBS, has apparently boasted that Jared Kushner is in his pocket. And I think that that is a very easy person to fit. Trump and Joe Biden are both talking about kicking each other's asses. Theresa May tells allies to be aware of Russia and expel its spies. No sense of cooling that situation down at all. Trump's call, where he congratulated Putin on winning re-election, has turned into another administration uproar about leaks. And Mark Zuckerberg finally steps forward to say that the massive data breach, Cambridge Analytica, was all about helping with connectivity. It's okay. No, I know you can't do it. Help with connectivity. Trump plans trade tariffs and other penalties on China. And no charges for 11 Turkish agents who physically assaulted protesters in Washington, D.C. a couple of years ago. And a New York agency is investigating more than a dozen Kushner family buildings. All of these and other important non-surprises on today's Majority Report.
Those Turkish guys, that was last year, wasn't it?
That was yeah.
Because Trump was in office.
Trump, yeah, you're right. Yeah, exactly right. He was looking at it, he was like, why can't I do that? Now, apparently, the Austin bomber has left a video confession. It's not been elaborated on by police, and it hasn't been released to the public yet. But we will continue to monitor that. Sam is still out. He'll be back tomorrow. He's recovering. It's a M&M Thursday. And let's start with this sound. A couple of days ago, there was a really good forum on inequality, a town hall. I think it was it jointly between the Young Turks and Our Revolution? It featured Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Derek Hamilton, and Michael Moore, and I believe also Anna Kasparian was there. And I watched a fair amount of it. I was actually hanging out on the Discord, commenting on it. It was a good event, and I think it peaked. It certainly got well over a million people watching it. And Derek Hamilton is an economist and a serious sort of systems thinker of inequality. And so we wanted to just play this moment of Derek Hamilton explaining what you need to know about wealth when we discuss structural inequality.
We look at wealth, we know wealth is both the beginning and the end of economic insecurity or security. Wealth gives you, it's not just wealth as an outcome, it's what wealth can do for your life. We've talked about political power. If you got wealth, you can get political power. If you're faced with an expensive legal system, wealth will allow you to address that condition. If you have medical bills, wealth allows you to address your condition. If you want to send your child to an elite private school or university, those that have wealth can do so. We often think about wealth in terms of what the end is, but it really the real power of wealth is what it can do for people. It gives you choice, it gives you freedom, it gives you agency. Now let's think about what wealth is in terms of numbers. Senator Sanders pointed out in the beginning of when we started that the top 10% of households, this might be slightly different than the statistic he gave for the top 1%, the top 10% of households have over 75% of the nation's wealth. The bottom 50% of households have about 1% of the nation's wealth. So however unequal we are in terms of wealth, race becomes a bigger predictor of somebody's wealth position than class itself. The typical black household has about 10 cents on the dollar is the typical white household, and that's including home equity. We talk about the middle class. There virtually has never been a substantial black middle class if we're defining it in terms of wealth. And as I pointed out to you before, wealth gives you agency. I'll give a couple of more statistics and I'll sum up. We know that if you are a head of household and you're black and you graduated from college, your family's wealth position is lower than that of a white family where the head dropped out of high school. So this feeds into the narrative of, can we simply work hard, study hard, and address inequality? The answer is no. Those things are important. Education is important in its own right. So when Senator Sanders proposes that we should have tuition-free public education, absolutely. But as a as an end unto itself, we exaggerate the economic returns to education, particularly for marginalized groups. And when we start getting into these narratives of a post-racial society, we're not there. Now, we can come up with comprehensive programs that include everybody, but we need to do it differently this way so that we make sure nobody is left behind, regardless of your race, gender, disability status, etc.
That's brilliant. And he did a lot of work there, starting backwards. There's the perfect distinction there of getting rid of and getting away of the neoliberal education myth that skills and training will make up for structural inequality and a concentration of capital power in the labor market. It's a mythology which, just like we talked with Patrick Blanchfield with regard to guns, it's just responsabilization in terms of shifting burdens onto you as an individual agent or potentially facilitating small-scale interventions, sometimes in areas that are important, like increased investments in public education, but also in a current context, disasters, like facilitating people going into debt through federally subsidized loans to online colleges. The education will solve it myth is not only not going to solve the problems, it actually exacerbates a lot of others and undercuts what he was also saying, which is that education cannot just be looked upon as an economic activity. It produces citizens. It is supposed to train people to learn how to think, read critically, engage in a democracy. These things that are actually fundamentally important to any type of collective political or civic endeavor. He also raised those vitally important statistics on race and class, but in a way that reinforced the need for global universal delivery, which is brilliant. When people arguing for micro interventions can at times deploy the same statistics about structural racism, and they're right, but they use it to pivot away from universal debt-free public college, universal single-payer health care, universal public housing, a federal jobs guarantee. And in that broader system, Derek Hamilton also raised forms of reparations which could be synchronized with that. So it's very smart. And the type of integrative thinking that could actually go some ways towards really dealing with not only inequality as a sort of static problem, but the broader problems of increasing union power, breaking up capital, and rebalancing this sclerotic maladjustment, distribution of power in neoliberal deregulated capitalism. So it was very, very smart. And I'm assuming, was that a Lek pick, that sound?
Indeed.
I thought that was very, bless you. That was very
We were meant to have Derek on with, who was his partner for writing a piece?
Oh,
that was Sam's most recent tantrum.
Oh, actually. Right. That was, I can't get them to connect. Hello. God damn it. His face gets all red.
It would have been great to have him on, though.
I know, it would have been great to have him on. I actually called him up to tell him what happened, and very, very nice dude. Okay, we are going to take a brief break. We're coming back. We're talking with Luke Thompson. He is a political consultant. He deals in digital, and we're talking about, you know, not just the sleaze, obviously. I mean, the sleaze, the disgustingness of Cambridge Analytics as a company is getting very well documented. But we're going to get into the actual methodology and what they were selling, because they might have also been, hustling their own prospective clients. We'll be right back with Luke Thompson.
Sing muse of the passion of the pistol. Sing muse of the warning by the whistle. A night so dark in the waning. A dawn obscured by a slate sky raining. Five and 20.
Welcome back, Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Luke Thompson. He's a Republican strategist based in New York City. And in full disclosure, a friend. And this is pertinent information for this interview because I indeed regularly consort with the enemy. Luke, how are you?
Привет, товарищ. It's great to speak to your comrades in arms in the great historical struggle for revolution. Please, when the time comes, if you could make it quick when I'm put up against the wall, I'd be very grateful.
I'm working overtime to get you re-educated.
I've always really enjoyed rural Minnesota.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you want, you know, it's sort of like The Wire. You shouldn't say where you don't want to go or want to go. You know what I'm saying?
It's best to just say nothing.
It's best to say nothing or say, or better yet, whatever the revolution needs, comrade, I humbly apologize for my reactionary activity.
That's good. I'll start practicing that. You know who really should have also said nothing is Alexander Nix. That guy.
that guy. Well, this is what I wanted, because actually, no, you're really the perfect person to talk about this in some ways. And I guess you were, I should say for people, when I say Republican, I mean, it's certainly not Trump. Luke was on the sort of cuck side of the equation of the internal Republican battles. But, okay. Cambridge Analytica, and you know, you can tee off on them, and it's probably worth teeing off on them. I mean, we could talk about these undercover videos. We've played it on the show. I think the Facebook data breach actually points to much deeper issues that implicate, obviously, Cambridge, but in fact, Silicon Valley. And there's a lot of overdue conversations to be had about privacy and protection from, you know, the corporate sector as well. You can tee off on their ethics, but I actually want to also get into, like, what was the product that these guys were actually selling? They've been described as brilliant dark wizards, but it strikes me that it might kind of also be bullshit. But anyways,
yeah,
take it as you want.
So look, like, I first saw these guys in 2014 when they were going by the name SCL Group. They showed up to the National Republican Senatorial Committee where I was the analytics director. I was out of town the day they did their dog and pony show. So I missed the Savile Row suits and the Etonian accents, but I got their slide deck and I nearly fell out of my chair when I read it because it was facially absurd. The entire distinguishing feature of Cambridge Analytica is this idea of psychographic mapping, that they can identify personality types and then from those gain meaningful insights, not only into different sort of groups within the electorate, but also the messages that are going to work to mobilize those people. And like, let me be clear, this is absurd on so many levels. First of all, it takes for granted that personality types are rigid, but that political views or political behavior, more specifically, like vote choice, is fluid. All the social science evidence we have in the world suggests the exact opposite is true. Right. Personality types do exist broadly in the sense that using factor analysis, which is a statistical method, you can identify sort of correlated traits. And if you want to cluster those into five big personality types, you can. But these are not, you know, these are not like the dictates of the Almighty, right? Like Moses didn't come down from Sinai with one stone tablet that was like, here's the Ten Commandments, and on this other one, there's five personality types.
Right.
You know, these are heuristics that are used to help understand real-world phenomena, but they're not falsifiable. They're not derived from experimentation. They're just trends that are observed in the world. So Cambridge says, look, these five personality types have a direct linear relationship to your political behavior, but unlike, you know, your self-reported views on politics, your party identification, your age, race, income, et cetera, this is really what's rigid, and all that other stuff is sort of ephemeral. So what we can do is identify how your mind works, and from that, figure out not just what you're going to think about political messages before they're even on your radar, but which messages built into those political issues will change your behavior. So huge assumptions being made here, right? Mm-hmm. Mind rigid, politics fluid, political behavior fluid. They then, for instance, say, hey, guess what? We can get a hold of what your personality type is based on, well, you know, you start asking them and they get really cagey about where they get their personality data. Mm-hmm. We figured out pretty early on, we were doing Facebook surveys where they were paying people to take surveys on Facebook and you know, log in through mTurk to get categorized. But there's nothing wrong with that. I don't have anything. I don't think there's anything wrong with incenting people to sort of do a fun little game app so you can collect data. People are winning adults. Now it turns out, of course, they operate in the false pretenses of Facebook.
That's not what we're talking about here. They violated people's privacy in the terms of use, and that, you know, that's a fundamental asymmetry.
Right. But that would have been bad if they were Farmville too, right?
Yeah, like of course.
If not, right. So, look, you have these guys doing a bunch of Facebook surveys, as far as I can tell, in a pretty condensed period of time. And then they cut that data stream off in either late 2014 or early 2015. And then they're essentially riding on this couple hundred thousand collected surveys and their extended social graphs to basically do all of their modeling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, not only do they take for granted that, the human mind is rigid, politics is good, but they can get those mentality types from a very biased, stale set of data. And then those models, over and above any other form of sort of like micro-targeting, add these meaningful, massive efficiencies that make all the difference in the world in any campaign, not just a primary campaign, but in a general election presidential campaign. It's insane. I mean, it's just impossible. Look, I do political data for a living. I believe in the sort of efficient, optimized post-broadcast campaign. It's what I spend, 15 hours a day doing. But I'm under no illusion that I'm going to win or lose the race, except in very rare circumstances. And the fact of the matter is, I'm fighting for one point on the ballot. That's it.
Right.
Especially in general elections. General elections, it's just like partisanship does everything. You try to mobilize your people, and everybody dumps huge amounts of money on television to try to persuade the very small part of the electorate that votes frequently but is chronically indecisive.
Right. So then let's actually get to the ways in which, and one of the things that's the ways in which Cambridge Analytica just sort of plays itself out as a story. And I think I want to keep reemphasizing, I mean, the stuff that was exposed in the documentary, if that's true, then they're violating campaign laws. You're not even the most sort of like, there's a difference between being ethically ambidextrous as a consultant and saying like, no, we just send Ukrainian girls around or, try to sort of like entrap people with bribes. I mean, there's nothing sort of that's actually the opposite of their sort of like analytic woo. Those are pretty tried and true techniques. They just also happen to be illegal and they don't have, ethical discretion about clients is how I would put it. And that's not just Trump. And Uhuru Kenyatta, who, is a very intelligent, very charismatic Kenyan leader. He also is very much, plausibly wanted by the International Criminal Court. Again, the ethics are clear. But that being said, you've made the point that Cambridge Analytica has also served this really interesting cultural function. And the whistleblower who has been sort of doing the rounds and exposing Cambridge Analytica, the most interesting thing, one of the more interesting things he actually said was the way Cambridge Analytica, one of their most effective pieces of political strategy and public manipulation, was how they got Steve Bannon on board with their approach, which is essentially even changing their name to something like Cambridge Analytica and presenting this kind of sense of, as you said, Etonian sophistication and intellectualism, which would simultaneously validate Trump's, xenophobic rantings and Steve Bannon's sort of like cobbled together personal philosophy of, proto right wing, populism and ethno-nationalism. So that this was the firm that, even if it was woo, they aligned exactly with the people that wanted that woo to put an intellectual and analytic container around what they were selling anyway.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. I think it's important to keep in mind that, when they were SCL Group, what would become Cambridge Analytica had just sort of clownishly done graphics and images and reports. I mean, not just on the substance, but also on the delivery. After they got picked up by by Bob Mercer and a couple of other people and backstopped with some money, they hired a New York-based PR agency, which I don't actually think the name of the agency's come out in the reporting on this, which is
interesting. No, I don't think so.
Mm-mm. Okay, well, it's my understanding, and I don't have hard documents to prove this, but it was North Sixth Agency here in New York that basically did the Cambridge Analytica rebrand. And those guys did a brilliant job. I mean, it is their PR rebrand was one of the slickest and best I've ever seen. And they recognized in Alex Nix, the CEO, a world-class snake oil salesman, and they started putting him out there on the marketing tour, right? They stuck an earpiece in his head, and he would sort of give this, the standard rundown speech with good graphics and all of that. And because Americans have this kind of post-colonial tick that makes us believe anything a person with an English accent tells us, a lot of the default scrutiny that data and digital sort of wizardry typically got passed over in certain quarters, especially in the press in the U.S. You know, Cambridge benefited immensely from the combined techno-illiteracy and general innumeracy of our media class. I mean, very few reporters know much about digital marketing. Very few reporters know much about data science, and even like the sort of underlying mathematics. And so the folks who should have been fundamentally skeptical lacked the kind of resources to go in there and call the bluff on Cambridge. But it could have been easily done. For instance, you don't have to be great at math to say, right, so where does the data on personalities come from? Mm-hmm. How do you get it? What surveys are you, right? Like, but again, one has to have enough confidence in what you're doing to say, okay, well, that's the right question to ask. And the reporter class just didn't have that confidence or really like to buy into the idea that a whole bunch of Brits with secret squirrel connections in the MI6 and GCHQ had cracked the code on the mysteries of the human mind. And it probably made pretty good copy. And I mean, I think we're seeing it continue to make good copy as, otherwise sane people in the sort of broader hashtag resistance world are running around essentially vindicating Cambridge as evil but effective in saying, no, it is all true. This is the sort of skeleton key to unlock 2016. That's like, no, if you look at the FEC reporting, if you know anything about this industry, if you have listened to anyone involved in these campaigns, and this has been abundantly reported, these guys are jokers. They were jokers. Ted Cruz fired them at the end of 2015, quit paying them entirely, and replaced them with Targeted Victory. Trump baked them off against the RNC. The RNC's and Target Point, which is a different consultancy, they're a little two-man shop, beat Cambridge in a head-to-head modeling contest, and they got pushed out. And all they did in that entire campaign was place $5 million in digital ads, which sounds like a lot, but remember, almost $2 billion were spent in ads in this election. And, maybe your listeners believe that a JPEG of Hillary arm wrestling Jesus in Wisconsin is really the thing that made the difference. But I can assure you, it's not. Like, they were a fart in a hurricane. It was just nothing.
So what role for the, first the sort of some people around the Trump people and, the Mercers and Bannon, what is the cultural role of that hustle for them, and why were they sort of sold up into it? And then, I'll posit a theory. It seems to me that in certain elements of that hashtag resistance thing and the sort of Clinton dead enders, I think that you see a dynamic where it went from, basically an incredibly arrogant dismissal of a lethal threat, in fact, to the day after it went from, Trump's this, complete jackass, which I'll editorialize he is, to, oh my God, these were the secret, genius, brilliant, all-knowing evil fascists, and they won. Cambridge seems to kind of fit that function there too.
Totally. I mean, look, you're asking about sort of four different groups of people. So, yeah, you know, from
four different psychographics, which Luke and I can mine Facebook for you. Give us $30 million.
Please, 15. You know, why did Mercer give them $15 million? I have no idea. And I don't think anybody has an answer for that that's going to be convincing. He should have known better. If anyone in the world was well-equipped to call bullshit on them, it would have been him. So
he funds,
you know,
a lot of very weird stuff, though. Right, look up that
yeah,
guy in Oregon and urine. Mercer, skills don't translate. But anyway,
sure.
Yes.
But so that may have been part of it. But anyway, why he gave him money, I don't know. Why Bannon signed up, I mean, you know, Bannon believes some weird things about the human mind. This probably gave a technological veneer to some of his odd ideas. And let's be honest, the guy who's dumb enough to lose a Senate election in Alabama probably isn't someone that we should be looking at as, I mean, does he have a fixed address now? I don't, anyway, it doesn't matter. So, I mean, I think the reason the Bannon set embraced it was because it made them seem mysterious and dark, and they like to characterize themselves as evil because it's better to be evil than stupid. In terms of why Republican political consultants who did know better went along with it and were, you know, frankly, I mean, people were mostly pretty good about being blunt and unabashed in their criticism of Cambridge Analytica, but everybody was willing to give them a hearing because the sense was, well, if you hire these guys, if they're minimally competent, that'll be more than compensated for by the massive amount of super PAC spending that you're going to get from Mercer, who clearly either thinks they're a money-making proposition or believes in them. So, you know, all things being equal, if they're just about as good as the other sort of proven mainstream firms, you could get a topside bonus of Mercer funding a super PAC. So that's why I think the Republican political consultants were willing to at least entertain them, even though most of them wound up taking a pass at the end, except for those who were sort of forced to work with them. And then in terms of what it's doing for the, you know, the broader narrative in the Democratic Party, I mean, look, like, Hillary Clinton lost the election. She lost it for a lot of reasons. A major reason she lost it was because she's Hillary Clinton. Another major reason she lost it was that the coalition that underpinned Barack Obama's victory in the 2008 primary was precisely the coalition that she had tried to sort of strangle in the crib in that very primary, right? They were not well matched.
Right.
There was a lot of distrust between her and the new Democratic base, and the old Democratic base associated her with some policies of Obama's that they hated. Like, it's really, you know, it's not that hard to attribute her loss. Now, hard in light of the fact that she was running against a campaign that was not fully mature, I think we could say, to be delicate, and that was headed by a candidate that was not consistently on message. But you can mystify it all you want, but the fact of the matter is, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Sometimes elections you should win, you lose. And sometimes elections you should lose, you win. That's why we hold them. And don't just allow, you know, the staff at 538 to pick our enlightened lead for us.
Oh God, that is an absolute nightmare for both right wingers and socialists that we share. Our psychographic shares a revulsion at that idea. So I'm going to ask you in the last part of this conversation to really do some beneficial work for yourself in terms of getting out of the wall and into the re-education camp, which is that you're going to help us be, you're going to be a consumer advocate for people dealing with political messaging and consulting.
Okay. Yes.
So first I want to ask you, and I think, you know, I know a lot of people have read Victory Lab, which is certainly, mm-hmm. you know, probably dated in a lot of ways at this point, but that chronicled the sophistication of the Obama campaign, particularly in 2012, in terms of how they use data analytics. I guess if Cambridge Analytica is kind of the woo and the overstatement and focuses on the fluid personality and political choices are actually fixed and you're working in that 1%, what would be a good example? And obviously, you know, you don't need to give any trade secrets, but just a kind of general example of like a smart way of assembling a data strategy. Like what's actually going on there?
Sure. So, you know, first of all, you'll probably be hiring a firm to help you. And if that firm is frequently on the record talking about its clients without the client giving their consent, you should not hire that person. That was probably one of the biggest dead giveaways about Cambridge, was they were taking credit for things not in joint statements but on their own. Mm-hmm. They were making stuff up, saying they'd done things they hadn't. In terms of putting together a data strategy, you know, at the end of the day, elections are about, as I said, mobilizing your built-in supporters who are marginal voters and persuading people who are likely to vote who are on the fence. So the first thing you want to do is figure out who's in each of those camps. If you could bring them off the fence, would be your voter. And, you know, on the left, I think this is where Bernie Sanders obviously had a message that was very effective at taking folks who maybe weren't registered to vote or were registered as independents, because they sort of had a pox on both your houses mentality. And he could bring them in and sort of say, all right, these will be my supporters if we can get them into the ballot box. Trump did very much the same thing, right? He had this appeal that brought a lot of independents, disengaged people, both in the primary and the general election, out into the process. So that's the mobilization half. The persuasion half is a little trickier because you will have a good sense of everybody who votes because voter history is publicly available for purchase and in some states for free. It's not very expensive. Again, this isn't who you voted for, but it's whether or not you voted in a series of given elections. And so you can pretty easily identify who your high-frequency voters are. But then the challenge is to say, okay, how many of these people are hard committed to my opponent? How many of these people might be won over? In some places, party ID will do most of that work for you. Who are the Democrats? Okay. Who are the Republicans? Okay. In other places, like West Virginia or, say, Pennsylvania, that's not going to work because you have large populations of legacy registered Democrats who are mm-hmm. basically Republicans right. in their voting patterns. So you have to start digging into those folks, asking them questions about issues, and then you extrapolate to the general population based on these surveys where you see meaningful correlations. And it's both art and science. I will say it's becoming increasingly a science, and this is, I think, also why Cambridge Analytica seemed appealing. Everybody has the same baseline data file. This was the vaunted 500 observation on every voter in America. It's not nearly that sophisticated. It's your vote history. It's your address, phone number, everything that's in the phone book, everything that's registered with state government. And then it's an appended consumer data file, which is just a bunch of modeled scores for different behaviors that are put together by data vendors based on your credit card purchasing history. Mm-hmm. And all of that stuff is the actual personally identifiable information in terms of purchases is hidden, but they just aggregate it up and give you a score. And that gets you to, 250 to 500 columns, as well as, some first-party contact from the campaign, what they're seeing from DoorDash.
And is that the type of thing that could go with, like, that old, like, you know, and forgive me, I'm using these cliches that are really worn out, mm-hmm. but is that type of score that can start to be like, oh, well, you know, this person drives a Volvo and listens to NPR, so that's a Democrat in a certain neighborhood. Or this person, has a Chevy and likes, country music, Republican. Is that the start starts to correlate with from a consumer?
That's the kind of thing. Yeah, the consumer files are helpful for that. But I think that what's important to keep in mind when you hear about, like, oh, the Republicans drink Sam Adams and the Democrats drink Heineken, is that right. those correlations are actually just identifying latent variation in the population. So mm-hmm. what's really going on is the Catholics drink Heineken and the Protestants drink Sam Adams, but you don't have a reliable religion flag on the voter file. Hmm. And so instead, these are the expressed traits that happen to be kind of the term of art would be endogenous to the underlying cleavage that you can't observe.
Got it.
And the upshot of that is that they're not generalizable, right? Like, that may have been true in Massachusetts in 2012, right? It's not going to be true even on the same day in Mississippi, let alone 3 years later, right?
Right.
And yeah, so the consumer file is useful, but what anyone in this industry will tell you is that almost all of the analytic leverage we get is from a series of very simple variables: party ID, race, education, income, vote history. That's pretty much it. And so, you'll toggle on the margins, but even the toggling on the margins, which used to be a matter of intuition and a little bit of art, has been replaced by selection algorithms, you know, what they kind of fancily call machine learning. So everybody's using the same data and the same algorithms, which means that the industry is becoming more and more, or is increasingly offering up fungible products. And what Cambridge did in order to distinguish itself was to basically make up that it had this mythic bonus data that nobody else had. Mm-hmm. And it seems they tried to actually do it. That's one of the hilarious things, is that for a bunch of inveterate liars, they actually did seem to spend real money and expose themselves to real risk to try to make psychography happen. But fetch wasn't happening, because it's nonsense. That's essentially it. Is the question is, like, what is the new data that people are going to get? And is there a way to do it without, without breaking the law? And I mean, I have answers to that. That's what I do for a living.
Right.
But those are the trade secrets.
Final question. I mean, so, you know, what all of this raises for me, and as I said, like, even, okay, what Cambridge Analytica did with regards to Facebook and Facebook's, gross negligence with this, we can, in some ways, table, because that's just sort of inarguably sort of unethical behavior. I do think that there's a broader question here of privacy writ large in the digital age, which we're going to need to address. We're going to need to have a sort of different consumer bill of rights dealing with these things. But from a consumer point of view, if you think of us as consumers of political products, political campaigns, political messaging, I guess there's nothing we could do to sort of overcome the genius of Hillary arm wrestling Jesus. You know, that just sort of, some things just stand alone. But, like, what would you bear in mind, and what do you bear in mind when you're on the other side of the equation and you're looking at people sort of trying to influence you? What's your sense of, you know, how to be thoughtful about that sort of thing? Or is that even like a useful frame? I mean, this goes so far beyond sort of any individual responsibility, but I am curious about that.
I mean, I would maybe phrase it a little differently, which is, look, people have a lot of views about what constitutes privacy, and they're more kind of instinctive than they are really well anchored. There's nothing wrong with people going out and acquiring publicly available data about you, or purchasing data from companies you've agreed or allowed to sell your data. If you don't want to have your data sold, don't have a credit card. Now, that has economic ramifications, but also don't exaggerate the extent to which any single person's data is going to be useful, or even the extent to which you can be exempted from this kind of messaging cycle because you've decided to opt out of the system, right? I mean, the marginal record for a micro-targeting operation is pretty, you know, useless. But and you're always going to have the aggregate. So, you know, if you put it out there in public, you can't be angry when people organize it, just because they can now organize it pretty efficiently and at large scale. Make a decision whether or not you want it out there. But on the other hand, don't be under the illusion that going through extended personal sacrifice to avoid having your data on record is actually going to make a difference, because these are aggregate algorithms.
Well, this is, again, why I would argue we could get to it some other time, but this is exactly why you need regulatory apparatus to rein some of this in, because, of course, it can't be an individual responsibility one way or another. But that being said, I mean, is there anything, I'm even talking even beyond the data, is there something to, like, I guess what I'm trying to find is, like, okay, we have on one hand Cambridge Analytica, they're these geniuses that manipulate us and they know everything and we're just sort of useless pawns in their game of, like, essentially, you know, Facebook memes, essentially. It sort of seems like what they actually did. But then on the other hand, one shouldn't discount that actually, in fact, messaging and strategy is real and you are of influence to it. And it is something that I think in a world of, you know, we could take any of these flashpoints and kind of, people get obsessed about Russia. People are concerned about this, concerned about that. The reality is that there's a lot of different ways to program to you now and manipulate and influence you or inform and enlighten you and make the case to you. What is this? What's a, do you have any sense of sort of consumer or media literacy around that as a consumer, or, you know, just don't be stupid?
Yeah. I mean, don't be stupid is one thing. Also, there's a big distinction to be made between primaries and general elections. You know, there is a lot of strategy to primary. There's a lot of coalition building. You know, you don't have party ID anchoring and mobilizing people. So in primaries, yes, this stuff matters quite a bit. General elections are just like battles in World War One. They're just contests of resources. And the reality is that structural factors like economic performance and consumer confidence and stuff do way more to drive the marginal persuadable voter and the energy underpinning the relative party coalitions in the general election. So, you know, you have to campaign because you don't want to engage in unilateral disarmament, but it's mostly trench warfare.
So don't get too overly excited by any news profile of any new magical hotshot political startup.
Yeah, treat it all with a great deal of skepticism.
Lou Thompson, Republican political consultant, I would say candidate for re-education, if I have my way at least. And I have, of course, will have a significant leadership role in this. We've been talking about a lot of people today, though, who probably will not make it there.
Well, alas.
Luke, I appreciate your time as always. Thanks, man.
Anytime, brother. Take care.
Appreciate it. Okay, folks. Become a member of the Majority Report today. I thought that was, I think it's good to, like, get under the hood of this kind of stuff. It's like a... Every form of just sort of like PR writ large is essentially like, it's one of the main driving forces of how our world works. And I don't know. And I think, like, I agree with a Jane McAlevey that, like, of course, part of a left response, I mean, there's always going to be strategy, communications, brands, you know, like in the world we're in. But I think that ultimately it's a terrain that fundamentally favors the right and a corporate sector. It's sort of in its wheelhouse. But it's important to understand how it works. So I always appreciate Luke's insight on that. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member, justcoffee.coop. Coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the Majority Report. Use the code MAJORITY. Check out my show, The Michael Brooks Show, on iTunes or YouTube. And Jamie Peck's Patreon. And we will be back in the fun half. Yeah.
FightServiceSearch.com.
This is so deep. It's a deep state.
It's like being, really, like being gay in the 1950s.